Okay, we are on page 115, identifying with a fantasy. Actually, I think in today's society, the idea of building a positive self-image is understood as something that everybody needs to do. So that's not the way Elder Simeon looks at it. We're about to enter a new chapter to which I give altogether special importance. We'll be speaking about the idealized image. Based on some experience I have, and as an elder, he had a great deal of experience. I think we all suffer from this, and we good, in quotation marks, good Christians, those of us who think of ourselves as Christians, suffer from it even more. What do we mean by the idealized image? Every human being, apart from what he really is, desires to be something more. And of course, that's a good thing. To reach a certain point, so he shapes a good idealized image for himself. The neurotic type, and to a greater or lesser extent, this term applies to all of us. To a greater or lesser extent, we all belong to this type. The neurotic type relies on this image. Now remember, a neurosis, as far as Elder Simeon is concerned, is simply if we are moved by things that we are not aware of. The neurotic type relies on this image he has created for himself. He thinks that he already is this image. So he leaves behind the reality he is. Now, the reality of who we are is always based on our relationship to God, actually. You know, we've come up with a lot of ways of describing a relationship to God that lets us off the hook of dying to ourselves and living humbly in reality so that we don't build an idealized image of ourselves. And so he leaves behind the reality he is and passes over to this imaginary condition. His real self is one thing, while he thinks he is something else. And remember, a great deal of this is unconscious. He has been gripped by an idealized image, and forevermore he thinks this imaginary image is his self. Although the idealized image isn't reality, it exists inside him and influences him. Most often, this image has a flattering character, not necessarily, and he'll go into a comparison later on between three different kind of subtypes, I guess you could say. Most often, this image finds pleasure in flattering the one who created it. It wants to be liked by him. And he gives the example of, and I think this cartoon was in the New Yorker years and years ago, where an overweight and elderly woman looks in the mirror and she sees a young and beautiful, slim person that she would like to be. That's a kind of an extreme example. Physically, you would think, well, nobody, you know, actually does that. But what he's saying is that this is what we do inside of ourselves. There's the reality of how we are in comparison to the saints that we are created to be. And then there is the idealized image that we come up with, that we believe that we are. This is the idealized self image. The woman looking in the mirror wanted to be young and thin. She wasn't. And we want to be good and noble and strong and courageous and admirable, but we're mostly that in terms of this idealized self-image. The next page, the beginning of the new heading. What the primary characteristic of this image will be depends on the person. To one, it is strength. To another, good looks. Jumping down a few sentences. Yet another has an idealized image of holiness. We contemporary, good in quotation marks, Christians, good especially when we compare ourselves to those who are not Christians or those who are not Orthodox, have more or less identified ourselves with an idealized image. While we ourselves are a mess, we rise up in arms, supposedly, over holiness. Others are influenced by an idealized image of honor. Many fathers and brothers are touchy about the slightest stain on their daughter's or their sister's reputation, and they become real tyrants toward the women in the family for the sake of honor, family honor, embarrassed because of the way their daughters or their wives conduct themselves. He's referring to honor killings, I'm afraid, here. They have identified themselves with an idealized image of honor. Top of page 117, after the new heading, the person who has an idealized image inside him and has identified in some way with it is arrogant, haughty, he's acting completely out of character. Now, when he says out of character, what does he mean? He means that we have a character that belongs to us as God created us, and we're not acting out of the character of ourselves as God created us to be. Instead, we're acting on the basis of this idealized self-image. We'll be able to understand whether or not we have an idealized image inside us and have identified in some way with it from what we do when others acknowledge us for who we think we are. The really holy person isn't disturbed at all. But just let someone turn up who challenges the holiness of that person who isn't really holy but thinks he is and has identified himself with an ideal image of holiness, and the consequences will be completely different. Three lines down. When they behave toward him in such a way that they show him they don't take him seriously, that they don't pay much attention to him, he'll be disturbed. He'll be uneasy. He'll get nervous. And in any case, he'll act in such a way that he'll show completely that he doesn't have the legendary holiness that he thinks he has. And of course, you can plug in whatever primary characteristic a person is most interested in. And it's the same thing: strength, good looks, etc. Often, priests, but also good Christians with offices, rise up in arms, get disturbed, perhaps conduct a fearsome struggle and cause a big sensation about truth, about holiness. We've identified ourselves with an idealized image of holiness, honor, virtue, strength, or one of the other things that the idealized image can be built around. Since others don't recognize it, we want to assert ourselves on them in this way. Sometimes I have a note to myself, we can claim that we're defending God's honor. You know, and whenever I think of that, I think of Father Paul Tarazi and his caution against us at seminary not to defend God's honor, because God is not concerned about his honor. You can see how much God is concerned about his honor by looking at Christ on the cross. Top of page 118. The person who has something of some worth, if others recognize it, good. And if they don't recognize it, okay. A person like this doesn't get disturbed. A person who gets disturbed, as soon as others don't recognize something in him, certainly doesn't have any of those things within him that he thinks he has, regardless of whether or not he has a reputation. As a rule, the idealized image is unconscious. So we are not aware of the idealized image that we have of ourselves. We believe that it is the reality, but we react when others don't treat it as real. We are positive this is who we really are. This is our sense of strength or identity or wisdom. The idealized image is always, or rather for the most part, in the person's unconscious. While all those around him realize that he isn't acting correctly, and while it's clear that he has a very inflated, ostentatious, and false idea about himself, he himself doesn't realize it. He can sense in some way that he has a good opinion about himself, but the issue is entangled inside him. When he defends his idealized image, that is, his own imaginary virtue, he thinks he's defending high ideals, objective virtue, and idealism. And so, forgive me for what I'm going to say, you see, a person who is good for nothing from the viewpoint of real virtue can make a big sensation about virtue, about truth. Very simply, that's the way he relaxes himself. Doesn't feel comfortable unless he's doing this, is what he's saying. That's the way he receives pleasure. That's the way he vents. That's why such a person will put it on other people. He's identified with this imaginary picture, with the imaginary virtue he himself thinks he has. And he feels that if he defends virtue in the way he defends it, he's preserving his own virtue, his own holiness. Those who are affected by this illness can consider their errors, their mistakes, and I would say even their sins, as the best things about them. Others pay more attention to what they themselves are, while remaining in the grip of their idealized image. Others pay attention to what they themselves are, while remaining in the grip of their idealized image, that is, of what they want to be. They turn their interest toward their own reality. They are the people who, not in a healthy way, but in an unhealthy way, are constantly dissatisfied for no reason at all. In other words, some of us have an idealized image of ourselves, largely unconscious. We realize we're not as we ought to be, and we pay attention to what we actually are, and then we're dissatisfied with ourselves for no reason at all. All of this is going on inside of our heads, our unconscious minds, our hearts. We may act in a certain way toward others because we are confused in this way, but this dissatisfaction can come just from the fact that there is a difference between the idealized image that we have of ourselves, largely unconsciously, and at the same time paying attention to the fact of the way we actually are. If we are able to be aware of it and notice it, then we'll feel uncomfortable, constantly dissatisfied, but not doing the thing that needs to be done about it. The ascetic, the monk, beat themselves down like a fisherman will beat an octopus to soften it up. So I think this is what is being recommended to such a person rather than just this constant dissatisfaction. They beat down their self in such a way that it is invigorated, and so they actually give new life to their real selves by beating down this self-image, this unreal fantasy. The person, however, who wants to be his idealized image, while in reality he's something else, and pays attention to this something else that he is, and criticizes himself, reprimands himself in an unhealthy way, is literally displeased with himself for no reason at all. You know, when you come to confession, and you know, all you people express this kind of sentiment, and I'll ask them, what sins have you committed? Is this way you are describing yourself, where you're dissatisfied with yourself, has it led to some anger or some acting against someone or something like that? But they're confessing the dissatisfaction, not missing the mark, but you know, they think that they're missing the mark by not being the perfect idealized image that they have of themselves. You know, and Christ need not enter into this at all. We have this idealized image of ourselves, we see that we're not there, and we believe that spiritual struggle is about trying to get from where we are to the realization of that idealized image. We're not going to make any progress that way. That's one of the conclusions that Elder Simeon comes to. The person who wants to be his idealized image, while in reality he's something else, pays attention to this something else that he is and criticizes himself, reprimands himself, no confession of sins here, in an unhealthy way, just dissatisfaction. He's literally displeased with himself for no reason at all. And some people think that that's why we go to confession, to do that. He isn't invigorated like the monk. He isn't beaten anything down about himself. He isn't redeemed like the ascetic. Another person, the third type of person, pays attention in an unhealthy way to both things, what he is and what he wants to be. And he starts out saying, I should do this, I should do that.
We might come to confession and say something like that. I know plenty of people, Elder Simeon says, who think that if they struggle a little bit more, they'll become saints. A little bit more, and then a little bit more, and then a little bit more. It's precisely these people who see what they are. They see also what they want to be. And they are stuck in this latter condition and move between the two. In this way, they live continuously with a should. I know I should do this, I should do that, I know I shouldn't have done this or that. And they are constantly accusing themselves of not having struggled yet. If only they struggled. What is this, if you struggled? My good man, Elder Simeon says, humble yourself and let God have mercy on you. The person who is gripped in this way by an idealized image is completely motionless with respect to forward progress. The idealized image is a barrier. It stops the soul and doesn't let it develop. It makes the person conceited, arrogant, haughty, egoistic. While the person who truly sees what he himself is and desires to reach a goal of some sort without being trapped by an idealized image is humble and continually makes efforts, placing his hope in God, having always the awareness of his sinfulness and his weakness. This person makes constant progress. On the contrary, the other is constantly stopped. How is our spiritual life going? Are we making progress or not? If we aren't, surely something must exist inside us which doesn't let us go one step further. This is an idealized image which has dwelt in our soul. It's the very devil itself. And the irony is that we could think it is Christ. We can think that this idealized image is Christ. This is how I should be. And it's actually only an idealized image of ourselves. The Lord came and became man himself in order to tell us who the true man is. He wants very much to make us into true human beings, and he can do that as long as we decide to let go of all these idols our minds have created. Because Christ came to crush the idols. With a lot of humility, with a great deal of humility, run to Christ. Middle of the last paragraph. Only when man humbles himself does God come and have mercy on him and make him one of his people. And all of that struggle between the idealized image and what we see ourselves to be, humility has nothing to do with it. Only when man humbles himself does God come and have mercy on him and make him one of his people. I hope, my brothers, that this year God will help us to become human beings to a little greater degree. Any comments, reflections?
Steve, do you have any? It feels to me like my whole time in Orthodoxy, and maybe just in growing older, is kind of a slow waking up and realizing how I've lived in this, have this particular kind of image, and then I end up doing things that surprise me, and some of it's compared, well, I should be like this, but I'm not like that. But what I've been hearing from you all these years, and what he's articulated very clearly here, is even that image we have, that's some idol that I've built, or that we've built, that I've been, in my case, have built. So I guess the real question here is, for me, talking about Christ, and he is the mark, Christ being the mark. But there's something between me and Christ that my understanding of Christ, there's this, my understanding of who Christ is and how therefore I should be, that kind of, if we're trying to take our cues on how we should be from who Christ is, and yet in the mix of that, having some sort of a noise, confusion, sin, whatever that, and being able to say, well, I've missed the mark of being like Christ. That I think understanding who Christ is maybe where the confusion comes in, for me at least. I mean, thinking I have this understanding of God, but really not. This is something else. I've misunderstood who Christ himself is, or has been, or is, I shouldn't say has been, but who Christ himself is. I don't know if that made any sense or not, Father Jacob. All of this resonates with me, especially in the context of over the last decade or so of beginning the practice of regularly coming to confession. That's when all this has become more and more obvious to me. I do feel though that something is still missing from my understanding of this.
I think the way I understand it is that it's not a matter of understanding. That we can't understand ourselves into being Christ-like. The problem is that we are already something that is contrary to Christ. And there's no substitute for humility. We could come up with a new and spruced up image of Christ, and it will be an image of ourselves. It will be an idealized image of ourselves, taken exactly from those things that bubble up from our unconscious as the things that we most want to be. Strong, wise, respected, whatever they are, they're there. There is no substitute for getting rid of them, eradicating them, rubbing them out. Understanding things in a different way, understanding Christ in a different way, is not going to work, because we're trying to... God is as he is. Christ is, has revealed himself in the way that he reveals himself in the New Testament. God is not concerned about his honor. He's not concerned about, and has no reason to be concerned about, power or authority or a good reputation in this world. He becomes incarnate. He reveals what it means to be a true human being. He's humble. There's no need for him to establish himself in the ways that we try to establish ourselves. And he tries to convince us that it is the same for us, because who we are depends on him, not on our understanding, not on our abilities, not on our having a good opinion of ourselves or an acceptable opinion of ourselves. He tells us to turn the other cheek, and it's not practical in our world, because if you start doing that, people are going to start taking advantage of you. You need a reputation where people don't take advantage of you. You need to stand up for yourself. All these ways of thinking that we have about the way we have to function as human beings in this world are based on false images of ourselves. We can change the false image, and it doesn't really matter how we change it or how we change our understanding of who we think Christ is. It's a matter of dealing with the unreality in ourselves. The book from the beginning, it's in all this time it's spent talking about the alternatives that we take to a proper stance before God, a stance of humility before God, moving toward others, moving against them in order to establish ourselves, moving away from others to establish our sense of ourselves within ourselves, and especially that third alternative of establishing our sense of ourselves within ourselves, moving away from others. That really amounts to saying no to God, because the only alternative when we decide to try to establish ourselves within ourselves, according to an idealized image that we have within ourselves, well, we have said no to God by doing that in a way that's even worse than the first two ways of moving away from where we ought to be. The first way, moving toward others, kind of glomming ourselves onto them, going along, or if we're not in a group we can go along with, then we reject that group, we go to another group so that we can go along with that group, or moving against others, acting against others, trying to be dominant, establish ourselves. But at least both of those ways involve active interaction with others. But the third way, moving inward within ourselves and isolating ourselves from others, that, it seems to me, in a certain kind of way, and I think Elder Simeon bears this out in how he talks about it, is worse than the other two. Because it's claiming we don't need anyone. There's even a sense that that would be a kind of spirituality. Turning away from others, it means turning away from God too. So it's saying no to others, it's saying no to God, and trying to establish ourselves within ourselves on the basis of an idealized image. Well, that's not a direct response to what you were talking about, but I think this business of recognizing that we have an idealized image of ourselves and not falling prey to one of the alternatives that he's mentioned, just kind of being so completely in the grip of this idealized image of ourselves that we think that's who we are. And if anybody doesn't recognize it or acknowledge our strong qualities that we think we have, then we just lash out against them. And they deserve it. And we feel good about it. We feel good about ourselves. That's the first way. Or we can realize that we have an idealized image. We don't realize that it is an idealized image. We just think that's the way we ought to be. And for a second type of person, it doesn't make us feel good about ourselves. We have the idealized image, and it makes us feel bad about ourselves. Because it's like, you know, we look in the mirror and we don't see a slim, beautiful person. We see someone who is not the way we want to be. So that we have that idealized image. This is not the way I want to be. I'm dissatisfied with this. I'm disgusted with myself. I hate myself. I fall short. I should be like this. And again, it's a matter of the idealized image, but a completely different relationship to an idealized image, a fantasy. Today, fantasies are sold on the market for a lot of money. You know, they're advertised and sold. Pick an identity. Variations, the alternatives are endless. We have games for children where we teach them how to go about picking an identity and adding appropriate accoutrements to some sort of fantasy figure, one or another. It's almost all there is left in a certain kind of way. There's one movie after another, one book after another, where people engage, young people engage in the fantasy of imagining themselves as this character and identifying with it. In society in general, it's the same way. We identify with, pick your character. There are a lot of alternatives. So it can never be a matter of coming up with an idealized image of Christ. I mean, back in the 1800s, when a scientific approach to history was becoming really, really a going concern, for the first time, people don't realize how many things are recent. And they tried to discover the historical Jesus. Every person who tried that, who made the effort as far as scholarly studies, ended up with an image that was an image that looked a lot like themselves. Because we can't see beyond ourselves if we're trying to function by understanding. Maybe my vision of Christ, maybe my icon of Christ is inadequate. Maybe I need to change it. In the end, we end up working more on our idealized image. Christ is not our idealized image. He is himself. He exists in a way that we don't, because we're lost in this confusion of identifying with this idealized image. We don't have to worry about who we are. That's, I think, a fundamental thing that, you know, I didn't know this, you know, my whole life or even my whole life as a priest. We don't have to worry about who we are because we are already somebody in particular. In fact, we can't get away from the things that we need to deal with in ourselves. But the spiritual life is a matter of dealing with those things. It's not about understanding things in a different way. There are some hints. There are hints in this book. This book is a different kind of approach from the other books that we've read.
Is this idea of having a kind of a deluded self-image and a deluded image of God, which would be necessary to have that, I suppose, well, is that like a matter of confession in itself? Like, you know, I just because of my sin, I completely don't really understand who God is and what I'm doing. Well, you just said it's not a matter of understanding, but there's the... it's willful, though, I think, sometimes. I think it's a willful misunderstanding. Which is, we prefer the... I wonder if it's that, you know, we prefer, or I prefer, the image that I would like it to be like. I think I told you before, when I was a... For me, what I identified with as a kid, when I was read through the Old Testament, well, I would go out and I thought of myself as a David, or you know, King David, or, you know, I think that's the one I identified with the most. But then I would end up, you know, in these situations where people didn't treat me at all. Look, I was King David. But not that I should be treated like a king, but, you know, with that level of fervor and holiness and that he treated, which is what I thought I was striving for, the reality of which was, you know, I wasn't. But I thought of myself in that way in some ways, I think. Just from reading through the Old Testament and the, you know, those five books in the, you know, Pentateuch and all that. And it led to some confusing situations. Why would they be upset with me? Why is there a problem? Sometimes I still have those.
I guess we're supposed to just find humility. We're supposed to be humble, right? I mean, I find myself, you know, just thinking too highly of myself sometimes and stuff like that, you know. Mm-hmm. Then I hear people, how they think about me. And I'm like, you know, some people who think a little bit less of me than I think they should or something. And I'm just like,
what we think other people think of us.
Yeah.
Because usually they don't let us know directly.
No.
So it's lots of times it's our interpretation based on how they don't treat us like if they thought of ourselves what we would like to think of ourselves, they wouldn't do that, you know, but that's our interpretation, really.
Yeah. I just
worse yet, they may not be thinking of us at all, not paying us sufficient attention, you know. So that's even worse, you know.
I mean, I find myself sometimes being bothered by just a misunderstanding I had with somebody like 12 years ago or something like that, you know. Mm. And I wonder, and I'm wondering, and I'm concerned, and I shouldn't be. I'm concerned, what do they think about me when I still think about how I blundered a little bit in a certain situation 12 years ago or something, you know, acted a little foolish or something in some way, you know. And I'm just like, I know this has to be somehow caught up in some kind of idealized image of myself, being worried and concerned about what somebody might think, because if they're remembering what happened 12 years ago, then if they are, and they're probably not, if they are, then they still think I'm that same fool I acted like 12 years ago, you know. And it's like, it just doesn't matter, you know what I mean? Mm. I don't know if I'm getting off track here, but I'm trying to. I just know that that's kind of...
Well, it's concerned about the image that we're projecting, for sure. And it's a kind of a good segue, good lead into the next section, I think, on 122. The idealized image and pride, because what you're talking about is wounded pride. Fourth line down, the second paragraph. On account of the structure of our civilization and the whole spirit of our life, contemporary man has a weakness for this illness of what? This illness of believing in the idealized image. It's central to our society. Every automobile, every game that's sold to a teenager, fashion, everything. I mean, if people didn't have idealized images of themselves, they wouldn't buy any of that stuff. The idealized image, the alternative idealized images, any image you want. You can have any image you want. You know, I remember then the end of the 60s, people who were countercultural, thought they were countercultural, big rebels, you know, were very disgusted when they realized that they could go to the store and buy everything they needed, you know, to look countercultural, you know.
Making the man a little richer.
Yeah. You know, because, okay, you like that. We got it for you. We'll reproduce it. You know, now you can all That's your lifestyle. Doesn't matter what lifestyle it is. Just so there is an idealized image that we can sell to. And the advertising becomes more and more focused on particular idealized images. And we'll realize that an advertisement, that's not aimed at me. That's aimed at some other person. Oh, here's the average. Here's the one that's aimed at me. This person is trying to sell me exactly what I need to build up my idealized image. Our whole society is like that. In particular, the unhealthy person has a tendency to want to be something. Something. And that's why he creates for himself an idealized image. An imaginary image about himself. Extremely lofty, and somehow he identifies with it. He doesn't understand that he has created something. But all at the same time, this image does its work from the subconscious. And we make our choices and we react to others based on this idealized image, far from reality, as it says the next heading over on page 123, middle of the page. The idealized image is something unreal, something imaginary. Ourself, however, is something real. You know, along the lines we were talking about Christ, and oftentimes our image of Christ is an idealized image of ourselves. That image is an unreal image. That Christ doesn't exist. There is one, but we can't know him unless we deal with our vices, our sins, the way we deal with others, the way we build ourselves up in our own imagination and treat others badly when they don't acknowledge the image that we have of ourselves. If that's the way we're functioning, we are not able to recognize the actual God made man, Christ himself. All we'll be able to do is come up with imaginary substitutes. I think there's an awful lot of that. You know, and in Orthodoxy, people can convert, we can convert as Americans to Orthodoxy and accept all the imagery and read all of the doctrine and not do any spiritual work and just wonder, why am I stuck? Why am I not getting anywhere? I think that Elder Simeon's book is an effort to get us out of that stuck place and to make us more realistic about what's actually involved. What could be keeping us from making any spiritual progress? It could be because we are hung up on some idealized image, which may very well be confused with our image of Christ, you know. We're very confused because of the fall, you know, Elder Simeon will say. Okay, the idealized image is something unreal, something imaginary. Ourself, however, is something real. The further away this image is from reality, from what we are, the prouder the person is. Great irony. The more high-minded and arrogant the person is, the further it is from reality. With the fall, man doesn't know exactly what he is, so he relies on something else. And each person creates an image for himself. And the further away this image is from reality, remember this is about know yourself, know how you actually are. Do you move toward? Do you move against? Do you move away? Deal with the reality of what you are. The further away this image is from reality, the greater the pride, the egoism, the arrogance. The further away this image is from reality, the more someone is ready to get angry as soon as people happen to make a remark of some sort, as soon as people happen to say something that belittles him. Something that isn't contained in the image that he has of himself. It's not fair. It's not right. 124 at the top. Only the shack that is ready to collapse needs support. So this is a knocked together self-image that doesn't have the benefit of any foundation or any reality about it. We have to keep supporting it. When a person really has virtue, he doesn't fear that he might collapse, because our real selves are not something that we have built. He doesn't fear that he will happen to lose something of what he is. And when I say that, I say our real selves isn't something that we've built.
And then people will have the idea, well, I have to discover my real self. You know, well, the only way you discover your real self is by doing spiritual battle against your sins and your vices. Who we are really will take care of itself. We don't have to understand anything because we are created beings. We have been created. We can have self-confidence in the fact that we are created in the image and likeness of God. And if we start to work on our spiritual life, there isn't anything else to worry about because there's nothing that we need to create. God has already created us. We need to deal with who and what we are, the way we are. And if we do that, then we're doing what we're supposed to do. There are some really strange ideas about Christianity that it's some kind of, God has a plan for you. Good grief, how secular that is. God has a plan for you. I mean, don't you know you're being sold something as soon as somebody starts out like that? God has a plan for you. Yes, the plan for you and me and everybody else is the same. Deal with yourself. Deal with the reality of your own spiritual life. God revealed himself and showed that it is possible for us to be human and to be in harmony with God. How do you go about doing that? You don't go about doing it by getting rid of the old man. But we don't believe it. You know, say, well, I kind of like the old man. Okay, well, then you're going to come up with some kind of version of yourself, some kind of imaginary thing that you play with while your life goes by. The only way to deal with it, the only way to avoid that, is to not be dominated by this neurotic and semi-conscious fascination with ourselves. So Elder Simeon is trying to encourage us to face reality. When a person really has virtue, he doesn't fear that he might happen to collapse. He doesn't fear that he will happen to lose something of what he is. There's nothing to be lost unless we turn to this building up of a false fantasy image of ourselves and believing that's us. When someone is frightened very easily, gets excited, flares up, has an outburst as soon as people tell him something. And I can see myself doing this. I'm not claiming I'm not like this. I can see myself doing it. You've seen me do it. We all do it. This means that he is in the grip of an idealized image. He doesn't know his real self. This idealized image isn't something that stands firmly. Jumping down a few sentences. Someone hurries to prop it up with his anger, with his outburst, with his assault, with his vindictiveness. This whole situation, three sentences down, is extremely unconscious. That's why it's possible for everyone else to understand what we are while we don't understand. We sometimes see a person praising himself, completely out of touch with reality. He, however, thinks he's in his right mind. Last three lines. He doesn't understand that there is something else inside him that makes him express himself and behave like that. He doesn't understand, although others understand. Final heading. Could it be that I'm out of touch with reality? Let's not be surprised when we see people behave in a senseless way. Next paragraph. On the other hand, when we see others get somewhat surprised at our own behavior, and sometimes misunderstand us, let us ask ourselves, why are others surprised? Why do they misunderstand us? What's happening? Could it be that we're out of touch with reality, in the grip of an idealized image, and everyone else recognizes it while we don't? That is, while all the others see what we are, we don't see it, and that's why we admire ourselves. I mean, this is our condition. This is our situation. Elder Simeon has found a way of describing our life in a secular world where we believe in ourselves. And we want to say ourselves, we can put it in quotation marks because it isn't ourselves. This business of the self is very tricky. I won't try to talk about it now because I'll just make it more confusing.
I think that the idea is that in some ways not even be that self-conscious. Not to be, you know, I don't mean not be conscious, but be thinking not so much about ourselves.
Right.
And who we are and our image and all that stuff.
We're always concerned about the impression that we're making. There's no need for that. And I'm using Imam thinking when you say that there's no need to be self-conscious. I am myself a highly self-conscious person in particular situations, especially in particular situations. And, you know, I struggle with it. But I am convinced that it is not necessary. We are at our best when we are not thinking of ourselves at all. We're able to do whatever it is that we can do without being self-conscious. Self-consciousness only gets in the way if we can read it out. First time I realized this, it had to do with writing, you know, and I realized that the wonderful thing about writing is that if you're doing it and it's going well, you are totally not conscious of yourself. You're totally involved in the doing of whatever it is that you're doing. And all of our life should really be like that. We never need to be concerned about the impression that we're making on other people. We're much more functional, we function at in the best way that we're capable of functioning, the less self-conscious we are. But this deeper level of an image of ourselves, it keeps coming back in education, the idea of self-expression. Children need to learn to express themselves. And the way it's gone about a lot of times in education, it just ends up teaching people to come up with a fantasy self-image. Because we believe in it. I mean, our society believes in it. And it's got nothing to do with Christianity. This idea of focusing on ourselves, I don't see how there could have been a Protestant Reformation without the coming into prominence of the idea that I am important. Here I stand, I can do no other, Luther said. You know, I mean, he's really arrogant. And he thought he was being humble. Well, Elder Simeon is coming up with a way of trying to reveal these things to us. This next section is really startling, and we won't have time to go far into it, but it's a good time to at least bring up this new topic on page 126. A person such as the person that we are describing sees his shortcomings as virtues. What hope is there for us if that's our condition? So we have to question ourselves. The idealized image is a figment of the person's imagination. It's something non-existent. It applies more influence over its creator in proportion to where the center of gravity of his interest falls. A person creates the idealized image, for the most part, subconsciously. I mean, I remember in the beginning of the book where he talks about how which one of the three ways of dealing with others you come up with depends on what kind of success you've had. It's that sort of thing here as well. An idealized image of ourselves will be created subconsciously depending on what has worked for ourselves so far. We shouldn't be surprised when we see a person swagger about, boast about himself, up to the point of making a fool of himself without realizing it. Final paragraph. One who has created such an idealized image thinks of himself as a man who is distinguished from others. He sees even his shortcomings as good, as virtues. And we shouldn't be surprised when someone has perpetrated a frightful mistake, an error. More concretely, he has committed a sin, and he keeps trying to persuade us that this wasn't by any means an error or the manifestation of a shortcoming, but it was a manifestation of virtue. This person is influenced by an idealized image, and in fact, he's identified with it. And then the next section has to do with unhealthy self-criticism, because there is a positive way to criticize ourselves. You know,